You're listening to sermon audio from Christchurch Hawthorne in Melbourne. We hope and pray this helps you grow in your knowledge and love of God and enables you to see how great God is.
This reading comes from Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbour as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets."
So, I'm John, obviously, as you all just found out if you didn't already know. I remember about 20 years ago, my father, who's sitting up the back, will remember this. I was in the city on the corner of Russell Street and Flinders Street, waiting to cross the lights on our way to St. Paul's Cathedral. We're going in. My dad's an Anglican priest, and we're going into the cathedral for a service. I don't remember the occasion, but I remember his friend who was with us asking me, "So, John, you know, what do you say when your friends ask you, what does your dad do for a living?" And I remember my response. I don't know if Dad does, but I said, "I tell them I can't remember." Well, who would have thought that 20 years later I'd be up here preaching a sermon on social justice? And yet we live in denial and we think we're not turning into our parents. I believe that every single human being, no matter your race or where you live or where you're from, has what I like to call a worldview-altering belief structure. That is, a set of thoughts, guidelines, or beliefs that tell you how to live your life, that affect their worldview. Now, this belief structure could be derived from the same God as mine, or from a different God to mine, from many gods or from no God, from philosophy or from science. But regardless of where they come from, I believe that everyone has one, a lens, as it were, through which they look at, see, interact with world, people, and objects. Everybody believes in something, right? It could be as simple as a love of money, material things, or power. It could be that you're driven by affirmation or adulation from other people. Even an atheist who places all their hope in science believes that there must be a scientific answer for how, at the very beginnings of time, matter was formed out of nothing, even though it contravenes the laws of physics they so proudly declare. As Christians, our worldview is defined by the works, life, and teachings of the man from Nazareth called Jesus. Now, I'm a rational, intellectual, educated person. I'm not a blind believer, but I am a believer. My life story starts with a Christian worldview without belief. I was raised in a Christian household, obviously, but it wasn't until I attended an Alpha course on my own as an adult that I was challenged to do the required thinking and took ownership of my faith and started down the path to becoming a follower of Jesus actively. The story of Jesus Christ is the story of God's expression of grace, forgiveness, and compassion. Born into human experience, yet also divine, Jesus' life has two distinct narratives. The first work of Jesus is that in his actions on the cross, as Stacey mentioned before, our right relationship with God is restored. Instead of us paying the price for sin, that is, our frequent rejection of God's view for us, for worldview for us, Jesus, God, takes that punishment on himself. God models for us in Jesus the ultimate in grace, forgiveness, and compassion. By forgiving us our transgressions, we are restored to living with God rather than excluded from God. The second work of Jesus, The second narrative to his life, I believe, is to model for us a way of life. Jesus says, I am the way. To him can we look for how we should be living. In today's gospel, we are given the two most important commandments. Jesus says the goal of human life is to love God and to love your neighbour. See, when thinking about social justice, Jesus doesn't just tell us to feed the poor or care for the sick. These are almost byproducts of a life lived following Christ. When we live for God and not for ourselves, in true submission to God's plan, our hearts are changed. Jesus is not calling out these people who need our help because helping the poor is a key to being a follower of Christ. Rather, because that is the action required at that time to restore the poor to right relationship with the rest of humankind. So in a sense, in this passage, Jesus is not telling us to give love. It's not love the Father and give love to others, but rather live in a state of love. He's talking about a way of life, a way of life that proposes living in right relationship with both God and with your fellow human being. So we're not talking about specific calls to feed the hungry or clothe the poor. It's not a specific call to fight for refugees. It's a call to fight to restore right human relationships with all people as much as it is with those people. When I was very young, my mother taught me never to walk away from the people that you love angry. As I've become an adult, I've heard it preached at just about every wedding I've been to. But I actually think it applies to other relationships as well. As I got older, I began to feel more intensely whenever my relationship with my mum was broken. We'd have an argument over family dinner at their place. I was probably being pig-headed and standing my ground. It's hard to believe, I know. And I'd head home to my place in the car, still angry. And invariably, I'd find myself calling her from the car to say, sorry. To tell her that I love her. To restore our relationship to the way it should be. See, I think we're all pretty good at doing this with the people that we love. Jesus would be pleased. To live in right relationship with one another is a good thing. It's to model Christ. But Jesus isn't just happy with us being in right relationship with the people we love. Paul says even evil people have dinner parties for their friends. No, the call of Christ is to show love to and restore right relationship with the unlovable as much as the lovable. In some cases, this will look like feeding the hungry or clothing the poor. In others, it will look like fighting for the basic human rights of people who have fled persecution to the point of death in their homeland, not because they're wrongdoers, not because they've broken a law, but based purely on their biological descent. We are called to show love to these neighbours just as much as we are called to show love to our close neighbours. I was brought up in a family, as I mentioned before, that was a Christian household. And my family cared, driven by my father, about justice, a huge amount. My father devoted his entire life to the gospel of Christ. He's an ordained minister. He worked for Melbourne City Mission and for Anglicare Victoria and other organisations of that kind his entire professional career. So from an early age, I was abundantly aware of how lucky I was, how much I had. Now, I suppose compared with my peers at Campbell or Grammar, I was poor. We only had a Ford, not a BMW. But compared to the rest of the world, I was disgustingly rich. And I knew that, and I felt that. And I credit my parents with keeping me aware throughout my life of how lucky we are. While I attended church growing up, and lived a life driven by Christian values, evangelism was never really a focus of our household. I respect my parents for wanting me to take ownership of my faith on my own and to not merely inherit the faith of my parents, as it were. But somewhere in there, I missed out on half of the message. While I got the justice half of Jesus' teachings, I missed the evangelized component. So you could say I got that we were supposed to love others, but I didn't get that we were supposed to love God and help others to love God. Maybe it's because the churches I attended as a youngster pitched their message above my intellectual age at the time. Or maybe it's because those churches aren't as focused on evangelism as they perhaps should be. Before I came to Christchurch, I spent a few summers at a Christian camp in America, doing the whole summer camp in America, defer becoming an adult. You know, we're good at that in our age bracket. I remember the application camp, the application form for camp. It was a Christian camp, and it asked me to summarize in three or four lines my faith. Not a lot of space, but it went something like this. Now, you have to forgive me, I was young. I hate that the church gets itself all worked up about peripheral issues, sex before marriage, homosexuality. I believe that once every homeless person is sheltered and every starving child fed, then we can debate those things ad nauseum. I studied Latin. Until then, I'm much more interested in the core of the Gospels than I am evangelism. I remember the reply from Tim, the camp director. To his credit, he still hired me. It was along the lines of, I share your concern for the poor and the oppressed, but I have a renewed heart for evangelism every day. It wasn't until I came to Christchurch that my heart was set alight and that I really understood evangelism. And while this was all new and weird to me, and still is, I struggle, it was also weird to see Christians who seemed to be all talk and no action. My worldview-altering belief structure told me that if God was real, and I decided that he was at my Alpha course, and I was committing my life to that belief, it told me that there was a bigger call on us as Christians than to just share the hope of eternal life in God to others. Early in my time here at Christchurch, I remember sitting out there with Nat, having a discussion about the division in the Anglican Church in Melbourne. Name-calling, judgmentalism, insults, divisiveness. That wasn't the conversation. That was what we were talking about. Name-calling, judgmentalism, insults, divisiveness. And that's just what goes on at Synod. I have seen the effects of this on my father, in his church, and on this church. On one side, it seems to me, we have people who make evangelism their priority at the expense of justice. And on the other, we have those who make justice their priority at the expense of evangelism. My dream is for a church where this divide doesn't exist. I believe both to be absolutely fundamentally key to understanding the Christian faith. Jesus tells us to go and share the good news of right relationship with God. The free gift offered to all is one that we should be excited about sharing with our friends, with our family, and indeed the whole world. But equally, when we have a holistic understanding of the scriptures, of what God has done for us, we should be driven just as much to restore relationships with those same people. So it's not just about doing good, but it definitely is still about doing good. In this sense, I see evangelism as justice in a way. As much as we can try to restore right relationships with people, we need also to help them to know Jesus so that their right relationship with God can be restored also. Sharing the good news is part and parcel. Jesus wants us to restore our human relationships, but also wants us to help others restore their human relationships. Restore their relationship with God. Throughout the accounts of his life, Jesus is abundantly concerned with the poor, the oppressed, the outcast, and the downtrodden. He brings these people front and center to his followers time and time again. He shows love to the unlovable and the unpresentable. He eats with tax collectors. He touches and heals lepers. He shows forgiveness to sinners like the lady at the well. He restores the value of every human. Every human. In Luke 6:33, Christ calls us to have right relationships with all people and not just our friends. If you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. We live in the nice first world. It's especially nice, I think, if you live in Hawthorne. I'm on this side of Burke Road. It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking you're doing okay if you love everyone that you meet. And yes, it's good to love everyone that you meet. But I think that as a society, we're taking part in what I call the first world delusion. See, we've become very good as a society at hiding the unlovable. We put the aged and the sick and the mentally ill into care facilities. And we band together the people seeking political asylum and we put them on an island somewhere off the coast of Queensland. Out of sight, out of mind. And so unless we go out of our way to find the people society has cast out, we're just loving people who are like us. And as Jesus says, that's of no credit to us. I believe Jesus spent so much time highlighting the poor and the ostracized in his time on earth, not because that's the goal, the inherent goal of life on earth, but rather because that's the area of most need at that point. He was highlighting the first century delusion, as it were. If Jesus were here today, I believe he'd be talking about the people on whom the human race has imposed oppression in this era. Jesus came to throw into focus all the oppression that we as humans have managed to impose on fellow humans. We need to take that lead and highlight the people to whom that applies today. I was in JB Hi-Fi on Saturday afternoon. And as I usually do, I walked past the row of nice big shiny TVs. Did you know you can get a 50-inch plasma TV? It's like that big for $500. $500. It's thin, it's flat, it's beautiful. Anyway, $500. Do we really think that that's the real cost to design, manufacture, and ship such a piece of high technology from China to Australia? I put it to you that it's not. I put it to you that it's because at various points along the line, humans are being oppressed. People working in Chinese factories for less than a dollar a day. And sorry, when I say a day, I mean 18 hours. As a culture in the West, we have outsourced oppression. We've normalized great wealth. We're incredibly rich and lucky, and yet we act like it's normal. Jesus calls us to actively seek out and restore the oppressed, as he did in the first century, so we should today. To be a Christian should be to believe that it's not acceptable to contribute to the first world delusion of oppression of others because they're out of sight and out of mind. Instead of buying into this delusion, we need to be fighting for restoration at levels that would make us appear foolish to the secular world. Paul famously says, "If Jesus hasn't died and risen, we are fools. The justification for all of our actions on earth are in Christ. If God has not restored us to right relationship, in other words, if God isn't real and we're wrong, then the acts we make in his name should be crazy to the secular world. The secular world is driven out of self-centeredness. To love and give to others is crazy if you're out to make the maximum for yourself. James 2:14 says that faith without works is dead. This is not a call to do good because you have to. It's a commentary on the fact that if you're not living out the call of Christ to restore the right relationship to the lives of others, then your heart has not really been changed. James is saying that if you claim to love God but you don't love your neighbor, you're actually not really loving God. If you don't restore the relationship with the brother, as seen in verse 15 and 16, then you delude yourself, and I think you haven't understood the scripture. We're all very good at doing that, myself as much as society. About 3 weeks ago, I was down in Windsor, near St Kilda, if you're not from Melbourne. And I was in a little convenience store on my way out to dinner with some friends on Chapel Street. I think I'd stopped to buy breath mint. And as I stood waiting to pay, the girl in front of me at the counter asked the shopkeeper if she could pay for the stick of gum on FPOS and get $6 of cash out. He wasn't having a bar of it. He said, "I've got a $10 minimum, sorry." The woman told him she only had $7 in her account. But he wouldn't budge. He couldn't help her. So she put the packet of gum down on the counter and walked out. As I approached the counter, I pulled out a $20 note from my wallet and bought my mints. But as I walked back to my car, I glanced down the sidewalk. The girl was walking away down the street. I got in my car and I drove in her direction. As I reached her, I pulled over, wound down my window and said, "Here, here's $10. She looked at me blankly and asked why. I told her simply, "Well, you need money, right?" She thanked me and I drove off. The feeling of elation lasted well into the night. I was on a good deed high. It feels good to do good. I wonder, though, has this been your reaction when you've done good? Do you feel guilty at delighting in your good deeds? One of the biggest realizations that I had during the preparation of this sermon is that it's okay to feel good about doing good. See, commonly when talking about feeling good about good deeds, Christians have a bad habit of guilt-tripping people, and they often justify it with Matthew 6. "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others." Contrary to first reading, however, what this scripture says is not that you shouldn't feel good about doing good, but rather that you shouldn't do good solely for the praise of others. And if you do, that's all the reward you get, because after all, that's just another form of self-centeredness. It's a behavioural response to the question, how can I advance my stature in a society that values giving money away? It's individual brand management. It's PR. You're growing your personal reputation by showing that you're one of those good people who gives money away. It's this acting for self-gain that Jesus is railing against. Ultimately, the reason why we should do good is for the glory of God. God's plan for humanity is that we live in right relationship with one another, as I mentioned earlier. If we are out restoring those relationships for personal gain, then we have failed and we've managed yet again to make it all about us. But on the other hand, if we submit to God's plan and love the unlovable and outcast to a foolish degree, as Paul exhorts us to, we should be shouting it from the mountains to encourage others in their good work and for the glory of God. Christians declare that we believe God has a better plan for our hearts than the material secular world does. As a follower of Christ, I am called as my life's mission to try to emulate Christ as best I can. When you do good, you feel good. Everybody knows this. Even pop culture knows this. There's a song in the musical Avenue Q, which I don't recommend, but there are some fantastic lyrics in some of the songs. And one of them says, when you give money to someone poor, you feel fantastic. I think it's an unyielding reality of the human experience. When you do good, you feel good. But I think there's something divine going on as well. See, in that moment of submission to God's plan for your life, your self-centered human heart is gone. It's replaced with how the human heart is supposed to act at all times. It's in moments like these that we catch a glimpse of what having a truly changed heart feels like. And it feels right. I want to put it to you today that that's because it is right. This feeling that we experience when we do good is what it feels like to be in right relationship with another human being. It's what it feels like to be in right relationship with our God. It's a glimpse at what having a truly changed heart feels like. I find this incredibly exciting. I find it liberating to not feel guilt at doing good, but rather to understand that feeling for what it really is. Rob Bell, in his book Velvet Elvis, which I mentioned earlier, puts it like this. Over time, when you purposefully try to live the way of Jesus, you start noticing something deeper going on. You begin realizing the reason this is the best way to live is that it is rooted in profound truths about how the world is. Jesus' intention was and is to call people to live in tune with reality. Jesus said at one point that if you had seen him, you had seen the Father. He claimed to be showing us what God is like. In his compassion, peace, truth-telling, and generosity, he was showing us God. And God is the ultimate reality. There is nothing more beyond God. It's a great book. Just as the prophet Micah did before him, Jesus has laid out what God requires of us, to love him and to love others. Or, as we've phrased it tonight, to live in right relationship with God and to live in right relationship with others, to restore value to our fellow human beings and to help them to come to know God. Now, you might be sitting there, not already a follower of Jesus, thinking either this guy's crazy or I want to know more. And if that's you, then I can't encourage you enough to pursue it. To pursue knowledge. I challenge you to investigate. Don't be content with just living. Do an Alpha course. Come back in April when Nat and Andrew preach a series on apologetics, which is a really big word for saying, justifying the reality of Jesus as God. Own a worldview-altering belief structure. And if you are already a follower of Christ, then today I have a challenge for us. Are we working consciously in everything we do to help restore right relationships between us and others and between others and God? Are you sharing the gospel and restoring value to people? Are we doing this to a degree that the secular world would describe as foolish? My hope and prayer for my church, Christ Church, is that this series will awaken us to a renewed fervor toward action, driven by love to restore our fellow human beings, to roll up our sleeves, as it were, and serve. I pray that Christchurch will become a church where we encourage one another in our love for the oppressed and the outcast. To the secular world, we should be people of a radical, disruptive faith modelled on the way we have in Jesus. Let's get to it. I can't wait.